Commander Wilkie, Real One. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Bristol in 1921.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a clerk to a barrister.
Did you go to school in Bristol?
Yes.
What kind of education did you have?
I went to QEH, it's a blue coat school. And I had an ordinary grammar school education. Leaving school at 16 to go into the civil service.
So this was in 37?
37, that's right.
Were you doing that when war broke out?
Yes, I was in the post office. I went to the post office, actually, and I was working for the post office when the war broke out.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we'd declared war on Germany?
An awful thing to say this, but it was a bit of relief because I was studying for exams and not doing very well, and suddenly I didn't have to study for exams, and isn't that petty? But that's... You know, that's what you're like, I suppose, when you're 18 or 19. It was all very exciting. We did a lot of digging trenches and putting together gas masks and things like that. I was only 18 at the time, of course.
Were you in any of the early bombing by the German Air Force?
No. I left Bristol to join the Fleet Air Arm in August 1940. And Bristol... No, just a tick. No, I missed the early bombing of Bristol. Bristol had a daylight raid, and my wife was involved in it, but I wasn't. I think I was down in Portsmouth.
Why did you decide to go in for the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, I was a grammar school boy, and all my colleagues, all my friends, were volunteering for the RAF Volunteer Reserve to be airmen. So I volunteered for the RAF Volunteer Reserve, and when I had my medical... They found that my two eyes didn't coordinate very well, and I was turned down for pilot. I was put on a waiting list for Fleet Air Arm for navigator, but I saw an advert, I heard it on the radio, that the Fleet Air Arm, the Navy, wanted pilots, and I thought, well, they won't have got together, so I'll try and be a pilot in the Navy. And I know what answers to give in the eye test, so I'll fake it. So I went down and I had my interview, and I passed my interview at Portsmouth, and I started to fake this eye test. And the man who was examining my eyes stopped. I put everything down. He said, "Now look, suppose you stop messing me around and you answer the questions I'm asking, not what you think the answers are." And he said, "Well, it's no use you being a pilot because your eyes don't coordinate properly, but you can be a navigator, so what's wrong with that?" So I took up the navigator option with the Fleet Air Arm. This has a curious... Can I digress?
Certainly.
This has a curious... When my eyes were hurting me a bit, about 1960-odd, and I went to an eye specialist in Orpington, and he examined my eyes, and he said, "I've examined your eyes before, haven't I?" I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Well, you've got a vertical squint." He said, "It's quite an unusual vertical squint. I know I've examined your eyes before. You tried to be a pilot in the Fleet Air Arm and kid me, didn't you?" Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Anyway, so I passed the medical, I passed the interview, and I was called up for the Fleet Air Arm in about August 1940.
And then?
I went to HMS St Vincent, which is a training school in Gosport, for 8 weeks, initial training. It was mainly on seamanship and the role of the Navy, and it really wasn't very helpful if you wanted to be a Fleet Air Arm navigator, but we learned drill and we learned some discipline, and generally speaking they knocked us into shape. Meanwhile I was given a rifle and 5 rounds, and was at night we were guarding Portsmouth against the invasion, so it was all rather exciting.
Were you in any of the bombing there?
Yeah. But oddly enough, the night Portsmouth was decimated, I was in a train, and they started, and the train pulled out. The train didn't stop, it pulled out. And I could see the bombing of Portsmouth as we pulled out. And the Royal Naval Barracks at Portsmouth were flattened, and Portsmouth received a right doing over.
Was that 41?
That was 40. Late 1940, about November 1940, because I'd finished St Vincent and I'd gone on to the signal school at Portsmouth in about December 1940, when Portsmouth was bombed. Our initial training was St. Vincent. Then we went to the signal school at Portsmouth to learn Morse and semaphore and about radio sets. And then we had 2 weeks at the gunnery school at Whale Island.
How were you treated in all these courses?
Like the lowest of the low, but then we didn't expect anything more. You know, we were Naval Airman Class 2, and as such, we were pushed around and shouted at, but it was all good for us, you know. Nobody ever takes. This is what happens to you when you're a recruit. They knocked us into shape, as they say.
Why was it so good for you?
Well, because we were fairly indisciplined. We didn't really know what obeying orders was. I'd been a youngster. It was good. We knew what the Navy was about. And there were some wonderful old soaks there, old hands there, who taught us the rules of the game.
What were they?
Well, the Navy runs on very strict rules. And what kept the Navy going in those days were mainly some very, very good chief petty officers. And, you learn what things you had to do smartly and what things you could get round and all kinds of tricks of the trade of how to be a sailor without actually incurring the wrath of the authorities, yet still having a reasonable time.
What did the Whale Island course consist of?
Well, that was tough. That was really tough. It was mainly gunnery, which was we had to learn how to spot for guns as a navigator. But it was also drill as well, general smartening up. And it's a tough place. But on the other hand, oddly enough, because it's so tough, you have a very strong affection for it, because it's sort of tough but fair. And, you leave it with a terrific respect for the gunner's mates and the gunners who are the products of Whale Island School. They are, in fact, the disciplinarians of the Navy on the ship, and you learn to respect them very much because their bark is very much worse than their bite. They're very good men, very good men, and the backbone of the Navy, the gunner's mates were.
What were the main things you had to learn in spotting for guns?
Well, they were rather irrelevant, first of all, although they helped to an understanding of the trajectory and what was likely to happen and how a gun could, gunshot was spotted and what amendments had to be made. In fact, the whole general sort of shooting from ship to ship was in the form of a ladder. That is, you fired the first salvos, you spotted where they went, and then if they fell short, you said, up 200, ladder, shoot. And that meant that you increased the range by brackets of 200 yards until you got a straddle. And we were taught this from the gunnery end, from the gunner's end, and which helped very much if you had to do any spotting, of what the things were important to them. Of course, it was very important for them to know if one gun was firing a long way short, because that meant there's something wrong with the pointers, something wrong with the equipment. But it was useful. Not that I ever used it except in exercises. I never spotted gunfire.
What if the direction was wrong?
Oh, if the direction... Well, the direction was rarely wrong, because, of course, that you could see very well. What there was always wrong was the range. And it was the range you were so helpful to, because when shot falls, it throws up a splash, and it's very difficult to know whether it's short or over or straddling. Direction is not really a problem when you're firing from ship to ship by line of sight.
And after Whale Island?
After Whale Island, we went to Trinidad, a naval air station in Piarco, Trinidad, to do our training as navigators. And it's very sad. We were the 44th Observers Course. And the whole of the 43rd Observers Course was sunk in a boat called the Arandora Star, I think it was. And so by the time we got there, they were very anxious to get some trained, so they truncated our course a bit, and really, we were really put to it very thoroughly. They even took about six of our most promising recruits early out of the course to bring them back to England to man squadrons. The Fleet Air Arm really were up against it. They lost 40. Potential recruits.
You must have thanked your lucky stars to be posted to Trinidad.
Yeah, well, yes, the other option was to go to Arbroath, but it was nice in Trinidad, you know, it was really a lovely place to learn navigation. There were certain advantages to navigating there. The Orinoco comes out into the South Atlantic round Trinidad, and the brown waters of the Orinoco go out about 50 to 100 miles out, and when you get to know it, you mark this on your chart. And this form is another way of fixing your position. It was very useful. And the wind is always fairly static. It's always 15 knots in Trinidad. But we, you know, they were tough on us, and we learned our trade. And you know, I learned my trade as a navigator. And when I left, I could navigate. Period.
What was the attitude of the local people toward you?
Well, they were very friendly, actually, because the Yanks hadn't arrived by then. While we were there, the deal about the basis for overage destroyers was done, and the Yanks arrived to set up their base, and things changed very, very considerably then. Very, very considerably. The Americans had the money, the natives liked to take their money, and we were very much second and third class citizens from the people out at Piarco. But the natives themselves were very friendly, and it was a lovely place. It was a lovely island. Trinidad is a lovely island. We didn't get paid a lot of money. We were able to go out about every other Saturday night for a meal out. But we made our own fun, played cricket, played football. But mainly we studied. You know, it was really a crash course. It was a very, very rough crash course in navigation, ship recognition, air gunnery, photography, and finally radar, because radar was just coming in. In the last fortnight, we had a very, very crash course on radar, airborne radar.
Was there any anti-colonial sentiment in Trinidad?
Oh, I don't think. I never came across it. I never came across it. I never came across it.
Were you there when America came into the war?
No. No. I'll tell you where I was when America came in the war in a minute. I was in a very privileged position when the Americans came in, and that I was standing next to the Foreign Secretary of Anthony Eden.
We'll come to that in a minute.
Yeah.
What happened after Trinidad?
Well, after Trinidad, I passed out quite well, actually. I was of the six were taken away, and of the next lot, I passed out top in the course, which meant certain things to me. We came back in a troop ship. I arrived, bought my uniform. They were so anxious to get us, they didn't allow us to finish our course for the fortnight at Greenwich, which was supposed to teach her to be a naval officer. I got home, only had time to buy my uniform, and I was given a posting. And I was posted to a cruiser called HMS Kent. And I was in a walrus on a catapult.
Can you tell me what that job involved?
Well, we were carried on the cruiser for reconnaissance and for spotting gunnery. I mean, the Walrus is a funny old machine. It cruised about 75 knots. It could carry, if it gave up some of the petrol, it could carry two 250-pound depth charges. But it wasn't really a very practical plane. It was, you could land it on the water, and you were hauled up by a crane. It was all very, very primitive. But on the other hand, you know, you were a plane carried on a cruiser. And we weren't used very much. I mean, we were on a patrol between Iceland and Greenland, and I flew a few times up there. Just reconnaissance to see if anything was trying to get around, see if any submarines were trying to come around the top of Iceland. But in the main, we were cover for Russian convoys. And we were on two of the PQ convoys. And in December 1941, November 1941, we took Anthony Eden, Major General Nye, Sir Alexander Cadogan, and Maisky, the Russian ambassador, to Russia. I gather from reading history books since that the object of the trip was to persuade the Russians what they should do if the Japs came into the war. And while we were on passage, the Japs came into the war because they attacked Pearl Harbor. And we had... this meant that...
I should say that you have in front of you your logbook.
I've got in front of me my logbook, which reminds me of the dates. Here we are. Vinga Bay. 17th of December, I flew in Vinga Bay in Murmansk. We took them up. It was a fairly uneventful trip because we were going at full speed and, we were not really in any great danger. We zigzagged and I did no flying at all. They couldn't have stopped to pick me up anyway. They wouldn't have dared stop because, you were a dead target for a submarine if the ship had stopped to pick the plane up. So we didn't fly. We were just there on board. And I in fact, kept watch most of the time in a thing called the plot. The interesting thing, of course, was that all these politicians and great people were on board our ship when Pearl Harbor happened. The immediate effect, of course, was that the amount of cipher traffic that was coming into the trip was colossal. And the paymasters who handled it and decoded it were working night and day to feed information to Anthony Eden. And Anthony Eden actually went sick while he was there. I think it was probably stress-related, but he went sick. I think he had flu or something. None of us ship's officers were dead pleased about it because we were all turfed out of our cabins. And I was sleeping in the Fleet Air Arm office on the upper deck. And most of the other officers were turned out of their cabins for Foreign Office staff and Russians and various people who were on the ship. And we came into Murmansk. Anthony Eden was flown down to Moscow. And I think we stayed in Murmansk for about 10 days.
Did Eden show any reaction when he heard the news that the Americans were in the war?
Well, everybody retired to a cabin and had meeting after meeting and meeting, and the signals were flowing in, and we were very much on the fringe. We weren't in the picture of what they were saying. But obviously the whole thing had been a terrible shock that this had happened at that time to mess up the whole. I mean, there was no purpose in his visit. I mean, his purpose of his visit was to talk to the Russians about what they would do if the Japs came into the war, and bang, bang, the Japs came into the war. Now, what's interested me is every one of the people involved have written a book, and I have read what they said about that trip in their books, and it really is quite interesting. Some of them say that, they were made comfortable by the crew. One of them grumbled like hell about the ship and the captain and the way they were treated. It was... Anthony Eden wrote a book. Sir Alexander Cadogan wrote a book, Maisky wrote a book, and all three of them, it's funny to read their various attitudes to that trip and what happened during that trip.
Which one grumbled?
I think Anthony Eden. I don't think he was best pleased. I think somebody referred to our captain as an old woman, an old fusspot, but be that as it may.
Was he?
No, he was a very fine man. His name was Angus Edward Malise Bonteen Cunningham Graham, a relation of a Cunningham Graham, who I think was a poet or a thing. But he was a very, very fine man. He was one of the best Navy captains I've ever come across.
And you said Nye was on the ship?
Major General Nye, who was the Deputy Chief of the General Staff. I mean, we really had some high-priced help there. It was astonishing, and I was just 19, sub-lieutenant. 20, I think he was, sub-lieutenant.
So if the Germans had sunk it, they would have hit the jackpot?
They'd have hit a jackpot, yeah. They really would. I mean, it would have been the same as sinking the... What was the ship that was sunk off the Orkneys during the 1418 war that Kitchener was on? Been the same effect as that.
The Hampshire.
The Hampshire, that's right. When the trip was over, we came back quite quickly. We didn't mess around. We weren't anything to do with any of the PQ convoys that time. We were just transporting these people. And we came back to the tail of the blank, to Glasgow, and disembarked them. And we had some leave, which was rather nice.
You said you were on PQ convoys. Do you know which PQ convoys you were on?
I don't think I've put them in my logbook.
Were there many merchant ship losses on these Arctic convoys?
Yes. We were on one convoy which had, I remember, we were, generally speaking, the Home Fleet lay off the convoy, ready to intercept if the Tirpitz or the Scharnhorst and Eisenau came out to attack the convoy. Usually we were about 50 or 60 miles away and between the convoy and Norway. But once the Kent was part of the close escort, and it was rather funny because the close escort that time was a submarine, was right in the middle of the convoy. They put a submarine in the convoy. And we had an attack from Heike 111s carrying torpedoes. And we all felt very sore, actually, because there were we firing off as hard as we could at these Heike 111s, and the submarine just submerged. And we all thought it was a bit offside, a bit cowardly, you know, to leave the convoy to sit there taking this attack while they sort of lay 40 feet down, sort of resting, as it were. It was just a joke, you know. We also had a ship with a Hurricane on it, and the Hurricane was fired off and shot down I can't honestly remember. I didn't fly because, you know, it was too cold. You'd never got back. You'd been covered in ice. You'd never got back on the ship if you'd been fired off. There was one convoy. I wasn't on the convoy which was scattered. You know, the one which was...
PQ-17.
I wasn't on PQ-17. But I suppose I was either close escort or distant cover for about three of them. But I didn't know any flying because it just wasn't wanted. It wasn't practical. You know, it was the water would have frozen over your plane as soon as look at it. And, you know, as soon as it just wasn't practical. We served no useful purpose. And indeed, at the end of the tour in June. In June 1942, they took the plane. They took the catapult and the plane off. It really wasn't serving any purpose at all. We were just a fire hazard on the ship.
What would have been the consequence of the walrus being covered with ice?
Well, it just wouldn't have any lift on the wings. There would be no lift on the wings. It would be iced up. Other interesting things which happened during the time I was there... We were in Seydisfjord when the KG-5 came in, and she had carved in half a destroyer in a collision. And I remember I was on watch, and the captain came up on the quarterdeck and got his binoculars out and looking. And I looked in the direction his binoculars were pointing, and the KG-5 had a big gash in her bow where she'd run into a destroyer. I remember that very well. And I was also on Kent when the news came that the Prince of Wales and
Repulse
had been sunk. And that was, I remember that very well. It cast a big shadow over the ship's company, over all the officers and the captain. That perhaps it hit everyone between wind and water. It really was a terrible blow. It was quite a low point of morale. I did a little bit of flying up there, a few AS patrols when the ship was in harbour at Seydisfjord. But I went ashore to Reykjavik, and I flew with it in a Whitley there for 5 hours 15 for anti-submarine protection.
Did you go ashore in Russia?
Yeah, went ashore in Murmansk, yes. Don't know whether I ought to tell you this story, but we were invited to a party, and... I was invited as the junior officer in the wardroom. There were four of us going. The captain, the first lieutenant, I think the torpedo lieutenant went, and I was invited as the junior sub-lieutenant. Anyway, we had a very nice meal, reindeer steaks, but there was some colourless liquid on the table, which I partook of. I thought, you know, it was some local, but in fact it was very, very strong vodka. The whole meal took about 4 hours, and we were all, you know, but we took a grip and we got back to the ship. And believe it or not, the ship was ordered to sea immediately because some German destroyers were outside the inlet at Murmansk is on, beating up some of our minesweepers. So we went to sea. We were on at sea for about 3 or 4 hours. But when I just went to my action station, I was all right, you know, I was fully accomplishmentist. Until when we came in, I retired to the loo because I felt poorly. And 24 hours later, They took the door of this loo off because I was asleep inside. And oddly enough, whenever I went for an appointment or anything, doctors looked at my sick record and said, "What's it say here? 2 days sick, Russian hospitality." And I said, "Well, I'd rather not dwell on that." But it was quite interesting. I remember I sat next to a hero of the Soviet Union, an airman called Grubanov, who plied me with this drink. And I was very young, I was 20, I should have known better. At least it taught me a valuable lesson. I never overindulged again.
What impressions did you have of Murmansk and the Russians?
Oh, the Russians were tough cookies. Oh, they were tough. The people were friendly but poor. But they weren't very... No, what? The people were friendly. The Russians themselves weren't particularly friendly to us. They put up with us, but that was all there was to it. We went ashore once or twice, but there was nothing to do there. There was nowhere to go. We just went ashore, went for a walk, and came back again.
In what way were they so tough?
Well, the way they treated cold. I mean, this was December. It was cold, and, you'd see ladies wandering around with short-sleeved frocks on, you know. The tanker, which was tied up alongside us, had mostly a female crew, and they were just had their shirt sleeves rolled up and didn't seem to take any precautions against the cold.
Were there any German air attacks whilst you were there?
Not while we were there, no. Not while we were there. But there were these attacks by German destroyers on the minesweepers, whose job it was to keep the inlets to Archangel and Murmansk clear of mines.
What was the attitude of the Royal Navy towards the Fleet Air Arm at that time?
Well, I remember I was in a cruiser, and they thought, well, they were nothing really we could usefully add to a fleet. We were in the wrong climate for flying off. I mean, the Japs used their catapult planes a lot, particularly at Midway, but we couldn't have used ours. The weather, I mean, the seas were mountainous. You couldn't have landed a plane on those seas. If they fired you off, it would be curtains, you'd have to make for Sweden. In fact, when the Bismarck was coming out, we had a chat with the gunnery officer, and we agreed that if we were fired off, we would spot shot for 2 hours, and then we would be released from that to fly and get as far as we could towards Sweden, because there was no way they could pick us up, no way we could land on the sea. The seas were so mountainous. Do you want to go now?